Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. Donald Trump had a rocky trip to Puerto Rico on Tuesday, where the electrical grid remains largely wiped out. On Wednesday, the president said that Puerto Rico's debt would be wiped out, sending its bond price tumbling and sending his budget director scurrying to say that he didn't mean it. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson felt obliged to say that he didn't mean to give the impression he's thought about quitting. And what did the president mean last night when he referenced the calm before the storm? Here in Baltimore, a respected lawyer is appointed to monitor the consent decree between the city and the Justice Department. Our panel today, Jonathan Lemire, who covers the White House for the Associated Press, Charles Robinson of Maryland Public Television, and Andy Green, the opinion editor of the Baltimore Sun. The Midday News Wrap starts right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall. It's the Midday News Wrap. Plenty of stuff going on this week to talk about. President Trump visited Puerto Rico and Las Vegas following the tragedies in both of those places. The NRA issued a statement about bump stocks, the device that the Las Vegas killer used to increase the carnage that he inflicted. They said, quote, the NRA believes that devices designed to allow semi-automatic rifles to function like fully automatic rifles should be subject to additional regulations. A few Republican lawmakers and President Trump's press secretary indicated a willingness to entertain that idea as well. The Nobel Peace Prize was announced this morning. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons was recognized for sponsoring a treaty to ban nuclear weapons, which passed at the United Nations. Of course, implementing it is quite another matter. As a candidate, Donald Trump criticized the Iran nuclear deal as a travesty. He is reportedly planning to decertify Iran, leaving it to Congress to think about pulling out of the agreement altogether. Reports suggest that his top advisors are recommending that the U.S. stay in. Here in Baltimore, Kenneth Thompson, a highly respected lawyer from a prominent local law firm, has been appointed to serve as the monitor of the consent decree between the police department and the Department of Justice. And Baltimore County is thinking about putting the Jewish high holidays on the chopping block for days off. A new poll finds that although Governor Larry Hogan is one of the most popular governors in the country, he may be vulnerable to a Democratic challenge in next year's election. So joining us on the phone to talk about all this stuff from New York is Jonathan Lemire, who covers the White House for the Associated Press. Charles Robinson is with us here in Studio A. He's a political correspondent for Maryland Public Television. And Andy Green is here in studio as well. He's the opinion editor at the Baltimore Sun. Good to have all of you guys back on the show. Thanks
so much.
Great
to be here.
And John Lemire, let's start with you. Last night at a dinner that the president held for several top military officials and their wives, he called the press corps back in to the White House during this photo op that they had where they were taking everybody's picture. And he used the term calm before the storm. He said, you see all this? And he's pointing to everybody he's in the picture with. This is the calm before the storm. Reporters, of course, asked what he meant by that, and he didn't elaborate. What do you make of that comment last night?
This was certainly unusual and a little bit ominous. First of all, the White House had initially issued a lid, which means they didn't expect any more public movement by the president last night, that reporters wouldn't see him. This was supposed to be just a private event. They then said, okay, actually, hustle back. We want to bring you upstairs and show you this. My colleague was one of the AP, was one of those in the room at the time. The president did not elaborate last night. The White House, when asked for comment or clarification today, has also declined to elaborate. It has certainly led to speculation that it could foreshadow some sort of military, if not action, but at least posturing, and perhaps that's in relation to North Korea. Perhaps that's a warning across Iran's bow, you know, ahead of a decision on the nuclear deal there. But it also, more than anything, shows you just how different President Trump is than his predecessors. It is hard to imagine others in the Oval Office sort of almost offering this to be continued, this stay tuned call, which he does all the time. He likes to milk drama. It is he knows how to move the headlines. He knows how to captivate audiences. He, of course, has a reality TV background, and we see this a lot from him. Even just last week, You might recall when the fate of Tom Price was up in the air, the president was asked about him out on the lawn of the White House and said, well, we'll see. We'll decide by tonight. I'll make my decision then, as if just sort of imploring folks to stay tuned. Now, obviously, Tom Price resigned before the president was able to make his own decision that evening. But this is how he does things. He's unconventional, and he is guaranteed to have people watching everything he says and does.
Charles Robinson, how does this play with his so-called base, the folks that elected a guy to shake things up, to make things different, to disrupt? It scares an awful lot of other people, as John Lemire mentions. I mean, it's perplexing at least, at the very least. How does this play with the folks who
I think his base
him?
Is loving this. They're eating this up. We're like, yeah, we want you to go, dude, go. Here's the problem. You're playing in a much bigger sandbox than, you know, just the United States. By keeping people off balance, he also has his adversaries guessing. I don't know if that's good or bad, but guess what? He's the guy with the finger on the trigger.
Yeah,
and you can read into it. And, you know, I think all of us are waiting. When is the tweet going to happen? And unfortunately, that's basically how we find out, I think, how his mind is thinking about things. Traditionally, we have a 5 o'clock, something happens on a Friday. And,
early Saturday morning. Or
early Saturday morning, Saturday morning. Yeah. And I think that, this stay tuned kind of mantra, and we've heard this before from this president, is somewhat foreboding. But, remind yourself that, he had an attack in Syria that nobody saw coming. He dropped one of the largest bombs ever in Afghanistan. I'm almost like, it won't surprise me what he does.
Mm. And Andy Green, in the context of the Iran deal, on the 15th, a week from Sunday, the United States is required to certify that Iran is in compliance with the agreement. The president has indicated that he is not going to certify them, although there doesn't seem to be much evidence that Iran isn't compliant
with the
agreement.
Yes, we've been certifying all along because all evidence we have is that they are, in fact, complying with their end of the deal.
And his top advisors reportedly, Mr. Mattis, McMaster, Kelly, the others, Tillerson, they're all saying, we should certify and we should stay in this deal. If he doesn't certify the deal and he sends it back to Congress, then what does that mean for geopolitical dynamics? What does that mean for the Congress and their new role in this? What happens?
It's hard to know what Congress would do. It squeaked the deal squeaked through the Senate the first time around. Barbara Mikulski, in fact, cast the deciding vote. Ben Cardin voted against it. And Congress has generally been pretty willing to take a hard line on Iran on a fairly bipartisan basis. So, it's hard to know whether they would be eager for the opportunity to pull out of this or whether they would find themselves in being the grown-up in the room in this situation. What certainly this does is isolate us further from the other parties that participated in this deal. Europe is generally much less hard on Iran than we are. They are not likely to follow us in whatever we do. This likely strengthens ties between Moscow and Tehran, which is not probably a good thing for us. There's a lot of risk in doing this, not the least of which is that Iran may feel unfettered and be able to pursue a nuclear weapon in one of the most dangerous, volatile parts of the world.
And John Lemire, there's some speculation that because there are so many people in the administration, senior officials, who think this is a bad idea, that the president is doing this because it satisfies his political needs, but that they're actually hoping that Congress will override him and not do anything to remove the United States from this deal. Do you buy that kind of narrative?
I think there are a couple things going on here. One of the few predictable things about a very unpredictable presidency is that President Trump is dead set in undoing much of his predecessor's legacy and accomplishments, right? That he has gone after much of what President Obama has considered his legacy. We've seen the repeated efforts to this point failed to overturn Obamacare. We have seen him announce that he would be pulling back from the Paris Climate Accords. We have seen him undo other Obama-era regulations, particularly on the environment. And the Iran deal is something that he, of course, criticized repeatedly, nightly, on the campaign a year ago. He has continued to sort of follow through on that since taking office, despite, as pointed out, that so far the U.S. and others have said that Iran is still actually compliant with this deal. If he does this, this would sort of allow him to, yes, satisfy his pledge to say, I'm decertifying it, I think this is a bad deal, but which would perhaps satisfy his base, but yet perhaps Congress keeps them in, and therefore it's sort of a, you know, it's sort of you're able to kind of broker some sort of public relations compromise. This is also, let's point out, a number of times where the president has sort of kicked the can to Congress on sort of hot-button controversial issues.
Yeah, you think of DACA, for example.
Exactly,
sure.
That's the next words out of my mouth, or DACA, exactly right. And that this seems to be a way where he can score his political points, but then let others do the heavy lifting.
And I think an interesting thing about this is that it kind of throws his Republican colleagues on Capitol Hill under the bus if, in fact, they are going to be the ones to save this deal. It allows him to cozy up to the conservative base and alienates them from it to some degree, which in an ordinary dynamic with a president does not do to members of his own party.
Yeah, triangulation usually happens in a different form, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's so striking that on the night before the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to an anti-nuclear group in Geneva, Switzerland, this is what the president said last night.
You guys know what this represents?
Well,
maybe it's the calm before the storm.
What's your storm?
Could be the calm before the storm.
What storm is
the
president?
We have the world's great military people in this room. I will tell you that. And we're not waiting. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
What storm, Mr. President?
We'll find out.
You'll find out. He says we have the world's great military people in this room. You know, this could be the calm before the storm.
Tom, the president enjoys something that George Bush kind of set in motion, and that is the ability to wage war without having to come back to Congress for anything, literally, as long as it's in furtherance of this idea of stopping terrorism. And I think that, you know, we're now, almost 12 years removed from that now, and we're still kind of operating in this kind of unique vacuum of, I'll tell you what war is. And that's where we are at this point. And I think, you know, and I know Obama tried to say, no, let's go back and revisit this. I just think that presidents going forward are not going to want to give up that ability to wage war. And from that historical perspective, it gives them enough leeway to kind of go, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do it in furtherance of protecting the homeland.
We're going to pause now and take a little break. We'll come back and talk about the president's trip to Puerto Rico, what's going on in Las Vegas in the wake of the horrible massacre there. Charles Robinson is a reporter with Maryland Public Television. Andy Green edits the opinion page of the Baltimore Sun. Jonathan Lemire is a White House correspondent for the AP. We're going to have more of the midday news wrap after a break. You are welcome to join our conversation when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To find us on Twitter, @MiddayTalk. Tom Hall, stay with us. Welcome back to the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. By the way, coming up Monday on Midday, it's Columbus Day, and there are plenty of people who think that celebrating the Italian explorer's arrival in the Americas back in 1492 is a bad idea. Los Angeles County will begin celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day on the second Monday in October, beginning in 2019. A Baltimore City councilman has proposed a similar idea for our city. We'll talk about racial sensitivity, political correctness, and how we remember history Monday here on Midday. By the way, a reminder that on Tuesday, we'll be broadcasting Midday live from the Baltimore Museum of Industry. You are welcome to join us at the BMI for that event. Joe Jones from the Center for Urban Families and the well-known economist and commentator Dr. Julianne Malveaux will join me, along with several other guests. We're going to talk about deindustrialization and the future of work. Tickets are free. Come to WIPR.org/midday, and we'll have a link that you can click to reserve a seat. If you've just joined us today, as I said, it's the Midday News Wrap. My guests are Andy Green, the opinion editor of the Baltimore Sun, Charles Robinson of Maryland Public Television, and Jonathan Lemire, White House correspondent for the Associated Press. If you'd like to chime in on our conversation about what's been happening in the news this week, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. John Lemire, a big contrast in the president's reception in Puerto Rico and his remarks in Las Vegas. He went to Puerto Rico, actually foreshortened a pretty brief visit anyway, left earlier than he said he was going to do, and took a lot of criticism for his tone and the events that transpired in his brief time there.
Presidents are often judged by their response to natural disasters or man-made tragedies. This president got two in consecutive days here, the visit, in the aftermath of the visit, the hurricane in Puerto Rico, and then, of course, the mass shooting in Las Vegas. And he behaved very differently in the 2 days. This is a president who has never displayed a great skill at empathy, that, he is a sort of a hard-driving guy. His friends and allies say to him that he's someone who absolutely, of course, he cares. He has a big heart, but he demonstrates it by action, not by words. But he's not one to parade around his feelings. He'll just get things done on your behalf. That's how he shows. In Puerto Rico, of course, he went into that. The White House has received a lot of criticism for being slow in their response to really understanding the scope of the devastation there. The president, of course, spent days feuding with the mayor of San Juan, or should I say criticizing the mayor of San Juan, on Twitter, even as she was, of course, surrounded by this horrible devastation there in her home city. His visit to Puerto Rico was, and some found it, the tone slightly odd. The iconic image, of course, is him shooting paper towels into the crowd like they were basketballs. He took a tour of a home in Puerto Rico and told its owner to have a good time. He talked about how the death toll there was comparatively smaller than, say, in the one in Hurricane Katrina, and therefore that was a real catastrophe, and perhaps this one was not. And also just even where he went, he largely stuck to the areas around San Juan that were not nearly as damaged as some of the more remote areas. The next day in Las Vegas, he, I think, by most measures, delivered what we have come to expect from a president in these sort of moments. He was far more somber. He was far more measured. Part of that is, and as our reporting has indicated, that I think he feels a much deeper connection to Las Vegas. He has a hotel there just off the strip. In fact, the word Trump is displayed in giant gold letters can be seen from pretty much anywhere around town. He has many friends in the area, other casino owners and real estate magnates. He stuck to carefully scripted remarks. He did toward the hospital to meet with survivors. He praised repeatedly the work of law enforcement, which is something he always does, that he feels very strongly about their efforts. And he believes that the death toll would have even been higher had the police there not stopped the shooter when they did. We saw him, on one hand, seem to struggle with this part of the job. It's not, being president is not just about the policy. It's often about being the consoler or the comforter in chief. And we saw him one day seeming to struggle with it, and the next seemed to be able to pull off.
Yeah, and for decades, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico has been plagued by huge budget deficits and lots of debt, estimated by most folks to be about $74 billion. The Obama administration, the Bush administration before them, Treasury departments and all sorts of administrations have been wrestling with what to do with this for years, decades, literally. And on Tuesday, before he left Puerto Rico, he spoke to Fox News, to Geraldo Rivera, and he said this.
We're going to work something out. We have to look at their whole debt structure. You know, they owe a lot of money to your friends on Wall Street, and we're going to have to wipe that out. That's going to have to be, you know, you can say goodbye to that. I don't know if it's Goldman Sachs, but whoever it is, you can wave goodbye to that. We have to do something about, because the debt was massive on the island.
Andy Green, Moody's Analytics estimates about $95 billion worth of damage from the storm, then $74 billion in debt. This is a mess, and the president just seems to be, as they say, shooting from the hip, and the bond market went crazy.
Well, obviously in his private business, President Trump is familiar with debt. He's familiar with bankruptcy. But the rules are different for governments. Municipalities occasionally have declared bankruptcy. States or common, or in the case of Puerto Rico, territories, no. And a lot of people have worried over time about his views about debt and the U.S. government. You know, at one point during the campaign, he sort of suggested, "Well, we can maybe renegotiate that too." And I don't think he's quite come around to the difference between going bankrupt as a business versus as a government.
I think one of the things that we need to watch specifically about Puerto Rico is the number of folks from the island nation trying to get to the United States. Right now, the biggest thing that everybody wants is a ticket to get out, because literally, not only is the infrastructure gone, there's very little.
There are people saying there's some areas of Puerto Rico that won't have electricity for
a year.
I
know.
It's crazy.
All of that.
Well,
and,
but Elon Musk is going to fix it. So he
well,
said so.
Well, the other part is
good for him.
Is that their main industry, which is tourism, is gone. And that's not going to come back quickly. And I think, and we've seen this, and understand there is another territory that the U.S. has here. It's called the Virgin Islands. That is also, it may be even worse shape because of the rural nature of parts of that island nation and commonwealth and territory, that, there are a lot of questions about what do we do? Do we rebuild? Do we put in place? Because understand this, they're all in Hurricane Alley. They're going to get more hurricanes. They're not going to get less, okay? And that means that you either have to redo how you build structures there, and second of all, you now got to be able to say, can I withstand a Hurricane 5, a Category 5 hurricane?
Sure.
And I don't know if that's an answer that everybody wants to hear, but it is a question that is going to be have to ask by those who are trying to rebuild both of those territories.
Yeah, and John Lemire, these kinds of disasters often occasion reactions. I mean, the $29 billion disaster aid package that the White House is said to be readying for Congress, it includes $16 billion for the federal flood insurance program and just about $13 billion for relief, and wildfires and all that kind of extra stuff. In Las Vegas, obviously the thoughts return to gun control or gun regulation. We all learned a new term these last couple of weeks, bump stocks. There does appear some consensus forming around at least the need to outlaw this particular gun accessory. What are you hearing at the White House and around D.C. about the chances for that?
There does seem to be some momentum there. The bump stock more or less turns a semi-automatic into an automatic weapon, as I understand it. And there have been some movement among some Democrats previously to suggest that this would, these should be banned. In the wake of the tragedy in the mass shooting in Las Vegas, the White House has signaled that they'd be willing to discuss it. Sarah Sanders did yesterday in the briefing. The White House has largely at this point said this is not the time for the gun control debate, which of course inflames some people who say the wake of a mass shooting is exactly the time for a gun control debate. But they have promised they will have this discussion on some sort of gun laws, and perhaps the bump stock is where focus will be. Some Republicans have come out and suggested that they will support this. Yesterday, in a significant move, the NRA has said that they would probably get behind this as well. Now, I think some Democrats and others who believe that far wider-reaching gun control laws are necessary look at this as saying, this is an easy one for the NRA to give up, that they can sort of feed this little thing and not have the bigger conversation, that they feel like this is an offering that would pacify those calling for gun control measures. So certainly there will be people who think this does not go far enough, but it does seem like there is at least some momentum, no sure thing, but some momentum that at least this piece could get done.
And Andy Green, people keep coming back to the sort of chaotic nature of this administration. Robert Reich had an op-ed that ran in The Sun just a few days ago, in which he notes that 599 key government positions that the Senate has to confirm the nominees for, Mr. Trump has nominated only 159 people. There are all sorts of people, like a third of the higher leadership positions at FEMA, to do things like the hurricanes in Texas and Florida and Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands. Those positions aren't filled. There is that bizarre press conference with Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, where he came out and he said, "I'm not thinking about quitting."
Right.
What do you make of all that?
Well, to some extent, I think this reflects what happens when you put someone in office who has no political or governing experience whatsoever. To some extent, it also reflects a philosophical orientation when you are putting people in charge of agencies like, Rick Perry's in charge of an agency that he couldn't remember that he wanted to abolish, that there are people, or like a Ben Carson at HUD, who come into these jobs not believing in the mission of these agencies in the traditional way, or certainly Scott Pruitt at the EPA, a guy who is...
Yeah, Betsy DeVos at Education.
Yeah, right. These are people who, it's not just a question of whether they are, on one side or the other of the philosophical line. These are people who have demonstrated fundamental disagreement with the traditional mission of these agencies. So the fact that they are slow in staffing up is part and parcel of not just a indifference or incompetence, but a active desire to not see these agencies perform their roles.
And it's interesting because this morning the Washington Post reported that the president has ordered the state of Iowa not to kind of come in and help the ACA because they want to reconfigure the markets where people would buy insurance from. This adds to what...
Yeah, the state petitioned the administration for funding that would have shored up the markets and made sure that, several tens of thousands of people would have been able to continue insurance. And the administration basically just didn't answer the letter.
This is not symptomatic. This is what they said they were going to do. They wanted to get rid of the ACA, i.e. Obamacare, and they're doing everything to undermine it, despite the fact that there are people who want to try and fix things. I think when you look at the administration and not hiring, part of it also is they believe smaller government is always better. It is not the behemoth, and they will be, I think they will use, going into the midterm elections, we have cut government size.
Yeah.
And you might not like it, but guess what? It's something that they can run on. Because think about what they're running on now. We got the Supreme Court justice through. That is it. Unless, Jonathan, you got something else that they're doing that I'm missing?
Well, John, they do point to the stock market and to the economy. I mean, jobs report out today. It seems to be a blip in the map. We lost 33,000 jobs in September, but that seems to be largely due to hurricanes. But the unemployment rate is as low as it's been since 2001, and virtually the stock market sets another record every time you turn around.
Yeah, the White House talking points on this do tend to be a little bit, shall we say, vague. Yes, they point to Gorsuch, of course, as a major accomplishment to this point in their term. And certainly congressional Republicans, many of whom are very frustrated at the White House, also hold up Gorsuch as like, hey, we got this. This is a big deal. But you're right. The White House, what they say is this. They say that the stock market is booming. They say that they've made tangible progress in the fight against ISIS, that they have, to this point, protected the homeland from a terror attack. Things of that nature, rather than being able to point to specific campaign promises that they've fulfilled in sort of the positive sense, like we've created this. As discussed earlier, they've undone, or at least tried to undo, some of what President Obama accomplished. But there has not been able to. There aren't really any legislative accomplishments this administration can point to. which is why they have put a lot of faith and pressure on getting some sort of tax deal done, that they feel like this is something that they really need as a win, and that a lot of Republicans on the Hill feel like they need to be able to show their constituents to say, hey, we got this done. Here's a win in advance of next year's elections.
Andy Green, what are the chances that the Republican Party itself and their various, factions can reach a consensus about the kind of bill that they want? We've seen that they had a very difficult time coming to consensus in health care. Is tax reform going to be easier for them?
I think that'll be a lot easier for them because it's giving away the cookies without taking anything away, in particular since many of the Republicans seem to have forgotten their concern about debt and deficits, that they are willing. There are reports that key congressional leaders are interested in looking at alternative analyses of the economic effects of these tax cuts to further the notion that they will pay for themselves to a much greater degree than traditional economics or actual past experience would suggest that they will. So that may free them up to do things that under the reconciliation rules in the Senate that allow them to slide things through with 50 votes and Mike Pence breaking the tie. So they may be able to come together on that much more easily than they did on the Affordable Care Act.
But they kind of seem to step on their message all the time, because Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury, apparently had a report that said he asked for a report on what the effect of a tax cut would have. And when he saw the numbers, he's like, well, we need to bury that because we don't want to talk about that. And every time he's come out in front of reporters, you know, people are like going, what? And I don't know about you, Jonathan, but it doesn't exude confidence.
Yeah. And you know, so much of this, John Lemire, and I know you're going to – we need to let you go because you've got things to do, places to go, eggs to lay. But before we take a break, all adds up. It contributes to this cynicism in government. It contributes to that governmental philosophy that so many people evidently had when they went to the ballot box last November. We have Mr. Mnuchin allegedly taking $800,000 worth of private chartered jets. We've got Rick Perry taking chartered jets. Tom Price resigned because of the $400,000 he spent on chartered flights. We have a Democrat running for Congress in upstate New York, a man named Steve Krieg. He's an optometrist from Plattsburgh. He calls his Republican incumbent opponent a child. She's a 33-year-old woman who's the incumbent in that district in New York. We have Tim Murphy, a Republican from Pennsylvania, resigning. He's known as an anti-abortion advocate. And now there's text messages where he's telling his girlfriend, with whom he's having an extramarital affair, to abort the baby that they thought they had created together. I mean, the cynicism here just doesn't seem to be dipping at all. How does the White House, do you think, purposely fueling these things? And of course, then we have these people in Congress doing all sorts of things to help them.
So I covered the Trump campaign last year, and a refrain near nightly at these rallies were the idea that Washington was broken. And that there were people there who perhaps didn't agree with everything then-candidate Trump said or stood for, but they believed that he would change things, that he would be a disruptor, that he would go in there and shake things up. They felt the sense that Washington was paralyzed, the sense that Washington was broken, the sense that Washington was gridlocked, and that no real change, no improvements were coming to the lives of everyday Americans. And now President Trump, of course, seized upon that with the idea of draining the swamp. That was the campaign phrase, drain the swamp, and that they will change this culture of corruption and so on. I think by most measures, one could say that probably has not happened yet, and that is sort of reinforcing, I think, a lot of the cynical views a lot of Americans have in Washington. The Tom Price resignation last week after the chartered private airplanes is a terrific example of that. I think the White House is aware of this dissatisfaction, this unhappiness. But I'm also not convinced that they are too anxious to address it head on, at least not the president himself. Let's remember, he is someone who, at every opportunity, and we saw it several times this week, went after another American institution, the media, with the idea of this fake news. And in this particular case, it was about Rex Tillerson and the report that he had called the president a moron. Last week, it was about the, you know, he accused the media of misrepresenting the situation on the ground in Puerto Rico, which I think for many, that struck them as a sort of dangerous move. Like, if you're telling people in Puerto Rico that they can't believe the media, then who's to say that they would, you know, perhaps they're not be inclined to believe a message broadcast to the media from the government or so on that warns them of danger, of another storm, of a dam failing, or of saying, hey, you can get water here or there. I think that the president has shown a real ability to seize upon the anger of his supporters and feeds into that and has set up a situation where they don't trust a lot of Washington. They don't trust a lot of the media. They don't trust a lot of the establishment in general. They just trust him.
And John Lemire, we trust you, and we are grateful to you for joining us this afternoon. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend, and look forward to the next time.
Sure thing. Happy to do it.
Jonathan Lemire covers the White House for the Associated Press. We've got a link to some of John's most recent stories at WIPR.org/midday. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more with Andy Green and Charles Robinson about a few local stories of note that broke this week. And we will take your calls and comments if we can work them in. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@WIPR.org. You can find us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall here in Studio A with Charles Robinson, a reporter for Maryland Public Television, and Andy Green, who edits the opinion page at the Baltimore Sun. We're going to take a look at some local issues. If you'd like to jump in, 410-662-8780 is our number, our email midday@WIPR.org, and to find us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. So Andy Green, a consent decree monitor after a long process has been named, a gentleman named Kenneth Thompson. He's an attorney at Venable, Bacher & Howard, a highly respected and longstanding law firm.
Yeah, and more to the point, he has real roots in Baltimore. He's a City College guy. He early in his career worked with George Russell, who's a major, major figure in Maryland's legal community and in the civil rights community in Maryland. And has West Baltimore roots. He's a kind of guy who has both the legal acumen to handle these issues and also some credibility in the city. So, you know, in that sense, it's a good choice. How this is all going to play out, though, it's hard to know based on how this consent decree team was put together.
And let's clear up for folks what the function of his team is to be. What's he in charge of?
So first thing they need to do is to start putting together a plan for how to implement all the things in the consent decree. The DOJ and the city came to early in the Pew administration. So that's supposed to happen before the end of the year. We also have Andre Davis, the city solicitor, former federal judge, another highly respected guy who's kind of manning this from the city's perspective. Also heavily involved in this. So, we should before the holidays, they're saying we ought to have a sense of how we're going to do, how we're going to move forward with all of the reforms, the new training, the new protocols that the consent decree calls for. So it'll be a little while before we know exactly how this is going to play out. But the job of this group is to really be on the ground, making sure the city actually sticks to it with ultimate oversight from a federal judge. Mm-hmm.
The selection of this group over the others has caused some consternation in some communities in and around Baltimore. One of the individuals who was part of a group that was trying to vie for taking over the consent decree was a guy by the name of Tyrone Powers. He's a former FBI agent. He had put together an extensive plan, and he essentially said the fix was in, that nobody was going to pick his group because of its radical nature of trying to reshape the police department. There were other groups who had a number of outside actors, and I'll just call them that, from former police chiefs to to folks who were coming in. So this selection is kind of like, I want to call it a safe selection, because it enables the mayor to say, I got somebody who was from here, okay? But the proof is in the pudding when you weed it all out. But there is still, I don't think anybody should be under any illusion, there's still a culture within this police department that believes that the old way is the best way. And I don't know how you get rid of that. And yes, we'll have to see how they structure what they said in this consent agreement.
I was at the Legislative Black Caucus, Maryland Legislative Black Caucus town hall meeting at Morgan State University a couple weeks ago. And Delegate Glenn, Cheryl Glenn, and Delegate Anderson, Kurt Anderson, were quite upset with the fact that Judge Bredar, who's overseeing this, appointed Mr. Thompson and sort of handpicked people from various teams and even picked a few people who weren't involved in the application process to begin with. And their point is that community input was ignored here, Andy. They're saying, you know, we had these specific teams who came and gave presentations, took feedback from the community, came back, revised their presentations, had constant dialogue with the community over a long period of time, and that's all got blown up by the judge, and he's perfectly within his rights to do that. But they're basically saying, because one of the established applicant teams wasn't chosen, we really don't know. We have no reason to be able to speculate what we're going to get with Mr. Thompson.
Yeah, or for that matter, with how well the various players on the team will work together. I mean, they're being thrown together by the judge. Maybe he's got the secret sauce for putting this together in the right way. Maybe he doesn't. We'll find out. I mean, another thing that I think is interesting is that this is all coming about at the same time that we're preparing to have the trial board hearings for the officers who were involved in Freddie Gray's arrest, which is, you know, another...
And that's, again, the internal
police disciplinary action. So after outside police agencies from Montgomery and Howard County investigated... we've gotten a recommendation that three of the six officers be fired, two of them face lesser sanctions, and one guy not face any sanctions at all. So we're going to start these trial board hearings at the end of the month. They will be open to the public. It's an unusual situation. We've got folks from other police agencies sitting on this board. We've got an outside attorney being brought in to prosecute the cases.
Which is kind of unusual.
Which is
quite
unusual.
Neil Duke, he's a former chair of the Baltimore City School Board, and a well-known attorney. But bringing somebody in from the outside, that doesn't usually happen.
No, and it's important to note, Billy Murphy, the attorney for the Gray family, has raised some questions about Mr. Duke based on his participation as a defense attorney in these kinds of hearings before. So we'll see. But the idea is the police department clearly wants to have outside eyes on this, that they clearly don't want the community to think we're just protecting our own. But, you know, that speaks to a lot of the tension that's going on right now in terms of how the police department is going to learn from Freddie Gray's death, how it's going to reform after the unrest of a couple of years ago. You're seeing a lot of conflict in and among, you know, between the department brass, the police union, the Vanguard Society, which is the African American officers group, in terms of how this is playing out, whether this process is fair. And I think that kind of skirmish is going to be a bit of a preview of what's to come in terms of how the consent decree plays out.
And Tom, make no mistake, the Fraternal Order of Police is watching this process very closely. Because
they too, ironically, complained that they weren't involved in the feedback process.
So right, but
we got all sorts of people saying that their input hasn't been considered.
And the fact that this is going to be a public hearing, of course, you know, pick your political poison, literally, because people are going to come out because they want to see how this is being dressed. Look, I sat through those Freddie Gray trials. And, you know, there were a couple of refrains that keep going over my head that I'm trying to get my head around. It was, one, what would a reasonable officer do? Two, we don't normally belt individuals in the back of the van because despite the fact that it's a rule. And, you know, and the fact that we're going to have this, call it a public spectacle, because that's what it's going to be.
Yeah, and the FOP, I should be clear, they were concerned about their lack of input in the consent decree process, not
right.
in the trial board.
Not
process.
In the trial board, right.
We just got a few minutes left. Andy Green, Donna Edwards,
yes.
a congresswoman who ran for the Senate against Chris Van Hollen in the Democratic primary and did not win that race, is one of four folks now vying to replace Rashern Baker as the executive of Prince George's County. Mr. Baker running for governor. Mm-hmm. We are in a political season. It's the nation stages of this political season, primary in June, election in November of 2018.
Well, that's going to be a terrific race to watch. You know, Donna Edwards is extremely sharp. She proved herself to be a really formidable candidate going up against Chris Van Hollen, who is himself a terrific campaigner. You know, I think she impressed a lot of people across the state. She's a progressive. She articulates her positions really, really sharply. She's not been involved in local government before, so that'll be a bit of a transition. One of the other names to watch in that race is Angela Alsobrooks, who's mm-hmm. the state's attorney down there. Also, you know, a lot of people have great things to say about her and high hopes for her future as a leader in Maryland. So that'll be a really interesting race to watch.
Tom, one of the things you want to watch is the old guard versus the new Turks. And it's happening not only here in Baltimore City, but in Montgomery County, Prince George's County. These are, I will call them the under 30 crowd sometimes, going up, people who have been in legislative positions for multiple years. These folks are kicking the door down, and they think that it's time for us to step up. And so that is one thing that I think you need to watch. This young group who is like going, nope, it's time for you to go.
Yeah, and here in the Baltimore City Council, we had that in the last
right.
election.
And now all of brand new virtually faces. All of the sitting senators in the city are being challenged by people, you know, half their age, more or less.
Yeah. Right. Andy, The Sun had a piece a couple of days ago about a new poll showing that Larry Hogan perhaps is, in fact, vulnerable, even though he is one of the most popular governors in the United States of America. They actually point to Mr. Baker as being the one at the moment most
who's
likely
closest.
To unseat him.
Yeah.
What do you think?
And Kevin Kamenetz, a couple of points behind in terms of closeness. That's the Baltimore County executive, of course. What I would say about that is this is very early, and let's not forget that Larry Hogan is a really, really skilled politician. He ran a virtually flawless campaign against Anthony Brown. He has set himself up quite well in office. He has not done anything to really alienate the voters who came after him last time. He has done a great job of distancing himself from President Trump. He's put himself in a position where kind of the crazier Trump is, the more sane he looks. So he's, you know, I would not read too much into vulnerability at this point. If I were a betting man, I don't know that I would be laying odds against him.
Yeah, a little early to do that. Yeah. But that is all the time we have, gentlemen. I very much appreciate seeing you guys and
thank
having you
Tom.
Guys come in. Appreciate it. We'll see you next
Always
time.
A pleasure.
Andy Green of the Baltimore Sun and Charles Robinson of Maryland Public Television. That is it for us today. Thanks to Patango Bakery and Cafe for providing lunch for our guests, located on South Ann Street in historic Fells Point. They specialize in imported Italian charcuterie and house-made breads and pastries. They're open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Their menu and hours are on their website, patangogelato.com/bakery. Coming up Monday, the Columbus Day holiday. Should Baltimore or other Maryland jurisdictions change Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day? Los Angeles County did it, effective in 2019. We're going to talk to a Baltimore City councilman, Brandon Scott. He thinks it's a good idea. We'll also hear from an historian named Anton Troyer. So what do you think? We'll take your calls and comments about history and holidays. And a reminder that you are invited to join us Tuesday at noon at the Baltimore Museum of Industry when we'll broadcast midday live from the BMI. We're going to talk about deindustrialization and the future of work. Come over to WIPR.org/midday and reserve a free seat. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall, except for days like today when it's Katie Marquette. Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill produced the program. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the midday theme music. We are grateful for production assistance from Sienna Greaves as well. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being with you next week. Have a great weekend.